For the second time in history, the podcast without a name is divisible by 10. Yeah. Divisible by 10. 10.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I'm divisible by 10.
My lord.
All right, 5, 4, 3. And this is episode 20 of a podcast without a name. Yo, yo, yo.
Yo.
What's up, everybody?
Oh, it's episode 20.
How is everybody doing?
It's been a while, I feel like.
It's been a while since I've joined you guys, I feel like.
It's been a while. You've been vacationing in the Keys, but you're no longer there.
So is life in the summertime.
YOLO.
The Keys don't even exist anymore, man.
Dunzo.
Climate change swallowed them up, bro.
Man, it's horrible, isn't it? I'm so upset about this.
I'm going to Mexico in 2 weeks, and I'm somewhat scared that we're going to have any more hurricanes to ruin the trip.
There's a few hurricanes going on down there now, I think, or at least there's one. But, you know,
Jose?
I'm sure it'll be gone by the time you're there, hopefully, inshallah.
I hope so.
Anyway, guys, we have...
I wonder if when they, like, announced Hurricane Jose, if everybody in Mexico, like, all together unanimously was like, "No way, Jose!"
Anyway, three topics this evening: civil forfeiture, healthcare, and the deal maker Trump working with the Dems.
Deal maker.
Oh yeah,
the art of
the deal. Art of the deal. He has that book. I did not read it. So, if someone wants to give us cliff notes, feel free to chime in. Anyway, civil forfeiture. This came up in relation to a video, and I believe it was a Berkeley police officer. Right? It was forfeit.
UC Berkeley, yeah.
Yeah, was some hot dog vendor, was, you know, viral video, and they took took his profits to cite him for not being permitted. Is it a permit or license or something?
Well, they said permit in the news story. Yeah.
Permitting, whatever it might be. Anyway, it invoked a lot of emotions out of a lot of people, but there are some underlying themes and underlying things there to discuss. This is something Rich is really passionate about, I believe, because I think it hits on his libertarian side of things, I think. And so generally speaking, civil forfeiture is different from criminal forfeiture. There are two different things. They both are basically a process for which the government, whether it's state, local, or federal, that can take property or money or anything of that nature from an offender. In this case, we're talking about civil forfeiture, which requires preponderance of the evidence burden, as opposed to criminal, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the skinny between the two situations. There's a lot of arguments for and against this being used as a policy. It's rooted largely in the war on drugs, for cases where, let's say some sort of drug dealers, from South America, is, moving drugs into the States, and he sells them and he's moving money back. If the drug dealer, let's say he's doing it on a plane or something, or even just the money itself is actually the drug dealer's money, since he is not in the U.S. to actually face criminal charges and go to trial, technically there was no mechanism for, say, the government to seize that money or assets in relation to the crime that they were committing. So what they did was, I forget what year this really all came to the surface, but I want to say the 60s, but I don't know for sure. So what they did was they instituted the civil forfeiture procedures, for which it gave an easier mechanism for that type of stuff to be kind of seized without having to have the criminal burden and going to court and things like that. And it's actually, some of the kind of nuance with it would be that in a civil forfeiture case, it's a civil proceeding, and usually we know civil proceedings as private citizens against private citizens. In this case, it's the police department versus the actual object itself, not an individual. So literally, when they invoke this, it's the police department versus my beer bottle. And I'm the owner of the beer bottle, so I need to provide the evidence on behalf of that beer bottle to prove that that beer bottle was not a product or a used in tender of something illegal. And then I could get it back. But I don't have to have beyond a reasonable doubt burden with that. Whereas in criminal forfeiture, it is beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's actually the state or government versus an individual. And you have to use beyond a reasonable doubt. And jury trial, bench trial, whatever it might be. So that's kind of like the cliff notes of civil forfeiture. There's a lot of really cool opinions about this just reading over the past couple of days. But, you know, that's the skinny for it. Rich, go away. Take it away, Rich.
My whole problem with civil asset forfeiture is that it seems to circumvent the due process laws that are, you know, set forth in the 14th Amendment. And also, it circumvents states' rights in some cases because there are some counties, states, what have you, that try to reform civil forfeiture laws. But those police departments, all they have to do is report the seizure to the DEA, ATF, whatever federal department that would be applicable to it. And because federal laws for civil asset forfeiture are lax due to the reasons that you said before, as far as being, you know, really meant to confiscate property of like international drug dealers, those things make it easy for and even incentivize local police departments to take assets of people, many of which are poor, and they give it to the federal government, who takes a cut and then returns in some cases up to 80% of that money to those police departments that then go to fund the police department. So it's kind of wrong on many levels. I don't think that drug dealers should be necessarily rewarded, but I mean, the whole problem is that it's extending the power of the government beyond probably what it should be, because, you know, your property is something that's, or your property being protected is something that's pretty central to, you know, some of the key foundations of our Constitution. So that's really my problem with the whole deal.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems a little bit bizarre because you have a situation where, you know, everything that's taken, right, in any sort of forfeiture, civil forfeiture, they don't really have to prove that particular, you know, and let's just say amount of money in most of these cases was due or was made or acquired through this, you know, illegal activity or whatever it was. You know what I mean? So there was that case a while ago in Philly where there was a kid that sold like $40 worth of drugs or something outside of the house. And because he lived at this house, the house was fair game for seizure. And you know, so like, and this can go, I mean, this can go in many ways, like, you know, the hot dog stand, right? Like, what if I made, you know, $60 and I just so happen to have, I don't know, $10,000 on me for whatever reason I had that kind of money on me. And now they can take all of my money just because of, you know, a few bucks that I made selling hot dogs. You know what I mean? Like, so there's no due process involved with proving where the money came from. And now basically anything's game to take. And I also think that there's a little bit of a conflict of interest, you know, on the police department's side, as far as, you know, seizing this type of stuff, especially if it's going to, you know, potentially go and fund certain departments, you know, later on in the game.
Yeah, and the three official justifications from the United States Justice Department would be punishment and deterrence, number one, enhanced police cooperation, number two, and revenue for law enforcement, number three. So, yeah, I definitely see that conflict of interest with the revenue side of it, especially for smaller forces too, if you think about it, right? It's very, it could be a slippery slope for a force that's, you know, maybe the deputies and whatnot actually are keenly aware of the budget shortfalls as they're out doing their job. Whereas, you know, a larger force probably isn't that aware of it, you know, as on the line level, if you will. So it's like, even, you know, there's probably some sort of energy there to, you know, if you know that your force needs extra money, maybe you will side on, you know, on taking that type of stuff and seizing that type of revenue, if maybe in other situations you wouldn't have.
And I mean, like, you know, think about this as well. Like, just say that I have X amount of money on me, right? Let's just say I have $300 on me and I'm driving somewhere and I meet the description of somebody that is thought to have sold something illegally or without a permit somewhere. And now they seize my $300, which to me is a huge deal, right? That could be my like savings right now. I could have been on my way to the bank to put this in my savings account or whatever, go buy groceries, whatever it might be. And now without any due process involved with that, it's just like, okay, we're taking this because we believe that you were involved in something, even though maybe in this situation, I wasn't involved in anything. So where is the process, you know, within this civil forfeiture law, right, that allows, you know, some sort of, you know, even mini civil trial or something before they can take away something?
Since it still is a civil process, there still is a mechanism, and this is one of the defenses that proponents of it put up, is that they say that there is still a legal mechanism there for people who feel that they were, you know, this is happening to them wrongly, to provide evidence to get their property back, right?
Right, to get it back, but yeah, not to lose it in the first place.
Yeah. But I mean, if you think about any area of criminal law and stuff, even with outside of civil forfeiture, I mean, the burden of proof is never a conviction on the spot, right? It's probable cause in many cases. So the fact that it's taken away itself on the spot is probably something that can't be mitigated. It's hard because they're not necessarily taking it because they're like, the guy on the street was put through a civil case and suddenly the judge said, no, you didn't prove it, give the cop your money because you weren't supposed to make that money, you didn't have a permit. It was because they're taking it, they put in evidence for the civil proceeding type of thing, and then the judge decides. So I don't know if I think if you fix the back end of this, the front end fixes itself, obviously, because then maybe they don't do it, or maybe they change their procedures on the front end. But it's the whole process on the front end is kind of the same for both scenarios, whether it's criminal or civil. It's really the kind of the process that it goes through after that. That's where the difference is, as opposed to having to have someone to convict in country or to get in front of a judge and actually have a trial, as opposed to you're actually putting the actual material thing on trial. And the owner of the material, if you think about it, is almost acting as legal counsel. They just got to show the evidence as to why that stuff was not used or obtained via illegal activities and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just feel like number one, that brings a you're guilty until proven innocent type of thing, right? Whereas, you know, most criminal cases are innocent before proven guilty, right? The other thing is, I feel like aside from the fact that I think it's unfair, I think this is a really potentially abused system. I mean, I feel like this could really go in some really corrupt ways if you know, if people are privy to, you know, information about somebody, and like you said, maybe the police department knows that they need some sort of funds or something like that, and they have a known drug dealer that, you know, maybe does illegal activity on the side, and they know that he does, and they just happen to see him and you know, seize his belongings based on something that has nothing to do with his illegal activities. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I was just going to say that the thing that bothers me about it too is, as I mentioned before when I was talking about it, a lot of times it's poor people that get affected by this. So say you're that hot dog vendor and, you know, you had $200 on you. You sold like 4 hot dogs that day, so that before the police came to you, and you made maybe $12 off of those 4 hot dogs. So now your $12, maybe some would argue, should rightly be taken away, but that other $200 that you just so happen to be carrying on you is now also taken away. So let's put that total at $212. Now, if you go to court, I know the last time that I went to court, the court costs alone are like $175 just to show up to a courtroom.
Yeah.
So you never go and get tried. And
but if you do win in a civil case, just to be noted, if you win in a civil case, typically the court fees are levied against the party that actually brought you there.
Right. But if you make $15,000 a year and you're living paycheck to paycheck, you don't have to
actually physically have the money. Yeah. Yeah.
On principle, you would be better off just taking the loss, paying your ticket and saying, shit, I just got $200 stolen by me, off of me from the police, because you can't afford a lawyer. You can't afford the court cost. So you're just going to pay the ticket. And now,
get that back, you might not have the money up front to even start that process, you know?
In the meantime, you're missing bills. Your credit's getting ruined. Now you can't get a loan when you want to buy a house. And, it builds up. It can ruin somebody's life, you know?
Yeah. And we do have to be careful, though, that we're not necessarily making broad policies based on a relative few. You know what I'm saying? Like, that scenario that you're saying, like, I guess in our minds, it sounds crazy to think about that this could be used in that. But in reality, the chances are that's probably pretty rare.
Well, not from what I'm reading, these are the people who are affected by it the most. It's very rare that like you catch the drug dealer with thousands and thousands of dollars and it's like a good get. A lot of times it's you catch the guy that was buying a nickel bag of weed and now they confiscate his car because it was, bought in the commission of a crime or used in the commission of a crime. And now you don't have a car to get to work. You lose your job. You can't pay your bills. You ruin your credit. And that's what happens. A lot of the time, I would say that the other end of the spectrum is the rare thing.
And just some interesting fact about this: Bernie Madoff, civil forfeiture was key in seizing some of his assets to return to the people that he swindled money from. And some of the stats for the breakout of asset forfeitures over some particular years. This is from the Wiki website. I could put it on the show notes for people to reference. In 1986, 90 total forfeitures was about 93.7 million. And then in 2010, the most recent that this chart has is 2.5 billion. So somewhere between that, I mean, granted, inflation and things like that. Oh, I just hit my mic. Whoops. Some of that's probably, the dollar was much cheaper or, more expensive back then than it is now, type of thing, but it's still a pretty big.
Just out of, just a couple of years ago, the statistics were that officials file thousands of forfeiture petitions a year just in Philadelphia and over like $6 million in cash and property was confiscated in Philadelphia in 1 year. I mean, that's pretty telling if you just look at a small, a small sample size there, just with Philly.
And I think if you bring up deeper parts of this, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Joe, I'm sorry, but if you bring up deeper parts of this, if you want to go deeper into it, it seems like people's lives are getting messed up from the war on drugs, and B, people that are just looking to make an honest buck selling hot dogs, maybe catering out of their house, doing something that's maybe not up to code or licensed or permitted, and they're just trying to not break the law, well, not break a serious law, and make a little extra money for themselves. They're the ones, I think, that probably are feeling the brunt of this more so than the international drug lord or whoever else is really it's meant to punish.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point that kind of brings it into that libertarian side of things, too. This whole, how much regulation is enough regulation when it comes to this industry, any industry in that regard. But we're talking about the food industry and things like that, too, with the case that the hot dog seller thing. You know, where's that balance to be had? So real quick, before we maybe move on to that, I think the big thing with this is if the premise for all this is was a real problem, why couldn't our policymakers come up with a different mechanism, right? Like you said, if it is disproportionately affecting people of lower income and maybe minorities in that regard, or anything like that, but our law enforcement officers and whoever the proponents are think that this is a necessary tool. So why not remove the negative sides of it, legislate a mechanism for law enforcement to still apply this to who they say it was originally targeted for, like those big money launderers, or not money launderers, but swindlers and things like that. Like, why can't we legislate then and get it to a point where it doesn't have such broad reach, you know?
Isn't that the crazy part of this? Is that we're hearing people on one side of the aisle, the Republican side, they're the ones that want to reform this so that people like that aren't affected. And you mentioned low-income people and minorities. How come we don't hear Democratic senators, congressmen, whatever, come out and say civil asset forfeiture is wrong? But they're quick to say that private jails are wrong and police are wrong for locking people up, you know, for being black or whatever, but they don't come out and say, hey, don't take that black man's money. You know, they say, you know, it's wrong to throw him in jail, but take his shit and, you know, don't throw him in jail, or take his shit and throw him in jail. You don't really hear people on the left side of the aisle talk about that.
So it's really to be fair, in 2015, Eric Holder, Barack Obama appointee, ended adoptive forfeiture, which occurred when a state or local law enforcement agency seizes property pursuant to state law and requests that federal agencies take that seized asset and forfeit under federal law. So there was, you know, Obama administration did apparently make some sort of steps towards limiting this authority, you know?
So just yeah, but probably fair. Not, and probably not enough. I mean, and that's, you know, good that he gave it a shot, I guess. I think maybe it's not quite a big enough deal or in the limelight enough for them to make a big deal over it, especially since the, you know, the idea that it can fund, you know, certain, you know, like police departments and stuff like that later. I mean, the conflict of interest that's built into it might not give them the big, you know, reason to stop something like this either. You know what I mean? Like, and again, that goes back into the whole conflict of interest type thing, you know, and right now, especially in the time that we're living in, where, you know, police and any authority is, you know, being, you know, looked at in such a, you know, microscopic level, something like this, I think, only can make that worse, you know, and especially like you're looking at this, you know, this video is a, you know, a bike cop that is emptying a wallet from somebody. And, you know, all the headlines are that this hot dog guy is being robbed basically by a police officer. And that's not a good optic for the department.
They should not like, and this, you know, maybe that speaks a little bit to the depth and breadth of what our country and our politicians and our, you know, our general policymakers have, the burdens they've put on the law enforcement, right? Like, should this be law enforcement doing this to begin with? Should they be the ones, like, yeah, we're talking about technically a law, but should they be the ones checking the permits for hot dog vendors? Like, they should have better things to be doing, you know, like, in my opinion. I don't know. It's,
well, they have a L&I and like the health department do that.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Have them do it. Right. Like they're, you know, there's, you know, policy, you know, pushers, the ones that, you know, let me check these boxes, make sure you got all your paperwork. Like, come on, man. Like, I don't know. I think it is, you know, there is something that we have to strike with the balance with, you know, making sure there's people are safely serving food, but I think we're still all individuals and we can make our own decisions too. Like, I don't have to buy the hot dog from the dude on the corner who's selling it out of a toilet bowl. Right. Like I could go up the street to, you know, Wawa or something like that and get a hot dog that was probably on a rack for 2 days.
And I mean, look at, was it the Circle K? They sold that, cheese. They didn't sell, but they allowed the cheese to be served. They gave people botulism. I think somebody died. Chipotle that was given like thousands and thousands of people E. coli. you know, and these are licensed businesses, you know.
They've crossed other T's, dotted all their I's, and they're still, you know, causing issues.
Yeah, so right? how effective is licensing? I mean, you go on that website, Clean Plates or whatever, and you can see businesses in your area that are that have been cited for numerous violations.
And think about the reach of those businesses too. I mean, the hot dog vendor doesn't necessarily have a network of other hot dog vendors that are handling the hot dogs the same exact way as he is and supplying them from the same exact vendor, right? He's a one-off situation. He might get a couple people sick or a dozen people sick, but that's it. But you have something like Chipotle, who may actually have all their paperwork in line and still effing up, but they're talking like very complex, you know, supply chain of food to, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of stores, you know, and suddenly it's not dozens of people, it's thousands of people who get sick. You know, it's like the problem isn't these vendors, you know. I'm not saying there's a problem overall with our food industry, right? I think generally because of capitalism and supply and demand that most businesses are going to try to do their best to make sure their products are the best and safest to begin with. But you know, that's a, you know, that's that argument again, when we're talking about the libertarian approach to all this to begin with, right? And markets and things.
And I think another telling sign is that we have a Supreme Court, right? Who's declaring whether or not this whole thing, the asset forfeiture, is constitutional or not. And really the only judge to come out and really say anything about it was Justice Clarence Thomas, you know, who is a, people would say, right-wing Supreme Court justice. So it seems to be, I mean, in my eyes, you know, I know you said Eric Holder came out and you know, said something about it, maybe tried to pass some legislation. But to me, it's more of an issue on the right than it is on the left.
Yeah. I mean, it does look like this has been challenged, and it has, the Supreme Court has mostly upheld it, but it's there's no case law or anything that's really kind of get underpinning this, you know, to kind of make it really that, like, it can probably be further challenged and maybe potentially be considered unconstitutional or something like that, right? So yeah, it is definitely on shaky grounds, in my opinion, for sure. I don't know, I think it's bad optic at minimum. Like, I don't know, it's just, let's say the best case scenario is it's really being used perfectly to get at these big time drug dealers or something, and it's working. But, you know, occasionally it happens, you know, some unfortunate person has their stuff taken away from them. And that's the perfect scenario, I'm saying, right? Like, even in that case, no one's going to talk about all the amazing things it did. You're only going to hear about the bad stuff anyway, just like with most other things in this world, right? So it's like, it's just bad optics too. And police don't need that right now anyway. They got bigger battles to fight right now when it comes to optics and public opinion. So I think our policymakers need to do them a little bit of a favor and kind of take this off their plate, you know? I don't know. That's just me. I'm just drinking beers. It's Friday night. YOLO. By the way, I don't know if you guys know. Did I tell you guys I'm drinking? I'm drinking 8-point IPA. I think I told you guys off air, but now on air.
Yeah.
So everyone knows. It's all right. I mean, I'm not an IPA connoisseur like you. So have you ever had it, Anthony? Have you had 8-point?
No, I have not. Actually, I was hoping to have a good, solid review from you, but
it's Devil's Backbone Brewing Company. Now, I mean, I've drank enough IPAs. I'm not sitting here over the moon over it, but I can't necessarily critique it. You know, like I've had better IPAs, I can tell you that, but I'm not disappointed.
I'm drinking a Sour Monkey. It's a delicious sour style Belgian triple made by Victory Brewing Company. It's delicious. Victory, if you're listening, just plugged you to about 20 people. So
yes.
I will take four beers. If you can send them.
Yes, I will take four beers.
They'll send you a sticker in the mail.
I'm currently sticking with a Philadelphia Brewing Company Yards.
Ooh, Yards.
I'm enjoying a pale ale.
Enjoy Yards. We do have our merchandise store that kind of came out with tpublic.com, I believe it is. Public Tea, one of the above. Anyway, some
Public Tea.
Yeah. So if you're here, check it out. Victory, send us some free beer. Go buy some merchandise. And let's move on to the next topic, shall we? What is our next topic?
Yes, sir.
What are we doing? What are we doing here, people? Oh, we were going to talk to, we could talk about the libertarian side of all this. Do you guys want to dig into that real quick, or do you want to kind of...
Well, I just figured, you know, because you guys are entrepreneurs and you could definitely speak more intelligently on the subject than I can, of just how hard it is and how much red tape there is to jump through when you're trying to start a business.
It's annoying. Because here's the thing with if you're starting a business, right, and let's say you haven't gone to business school or you don't come from, you know, you didn't, you know, grow up in a business or something like that. Let's say you just... You want to start a business, no matter how much you think you got everything lined up and ready to go, it's still always in the back of your head that I missed something. Mm-hmm. Like, and is that going to cost me big time down the line? We've had that happen a little bit, like some of the crazy odd things you have to do in the city of Philadelphia. Like, it's like, oh, great. I had a register for this thing. I didn't realize that. And now I have to pay $500 for that. Like, it's like, I don't know. At when and where someone's going to pop in from, whether it's state or, I mean, federal, I kind of got a good grasp on, but when it comes to like the city in particular, it's like, I don't know when they're going to say, well, you didn't do this, this, and this. It's like, well, F me, man. Like, and they make it incredibly hard to understand too. The websites, all the different websites for the government things, like there's always like caveats to everything, and there's no clear, well, if you're this, then you need to be doing this, this, and this. It's like, well, this entity issues you this number, but that's not the number you use to file when you do your tax for the city revenue. You have to take this file that you get from the state of Pennsylvania, this number from the Pennsylvania Department of State or something like it's like, seriously, like they do make it pretty difficult. And you know, being me and Anthony do, we don't sell products, right? We don't sell hot dogs or anything like that. Like, so technically, we actually have a more simpler version of it all. If we were actually selling stuff, we'd have all these other different tax things and accounts we have to maintain with the city and put money in those accounts and project it. It's crazy, it's nuts.
Yeah, they don't make it easy. And you know, putting that in light with the hot dog guy, you know, you have all this, you know, red tape and planning that's needed in order to make it work the proper way. And some people just don't have the resources or even the understanding that they need to do that. This guy was probably out there just thinking that he was doing the right thing and, you know, just, you know, probably not even thinking about the fact that it might not be, you know, done the right way or unpermitted. Maybe he did know, you know, who knows. But it's unfortunate that it's you know, just, you know, the money can be seized in that nature, you know, without having to figure out, well, what was this guy Juan thinking about? You know, what did he know that he needed a permit? You know, can we just shut it down for a little bit until he gets his ducks in a row? You know, do we really need to seize everything? Can we just maybe fine him or something like that later down the road for not having a permit or something? You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know. It gets on the whole topic of at what point, like, do we need all this stuff? Do we need to be permitted? Right. Like, even with the First Amendment situations, like, oh, you have to have a permit to be able to express your, you know, right to free speech. It's like, wait a minute. I thought I had a right to free speech. Well, you have to have a permit to do it here. It's like, but then where do I have my right to free speech? In your house, I guess. That's it. Like, it's like we have these protections. But then we throw red tape all over it, and it's like, wait a minute, do we really have this freedom anymore? Like,
right. And the thing is, you're, you know, they're making a lot of, you know, I hate using they, but you know, it's made so that somebody wouldn't really know all the different policies and procedures that are involved in something. But since they exist somewhere, you're just, you know, you should just know it. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like they covered themselves by making a policy or a procedure that lives somewhere. And if you don't follow it, you're screwed. We're going to take all of your stuff.
and it creates a situation. I mean, maybe this really speaks to that libertarian big government kind of problem, right? Like, if someone digs into you, they're going to find something. I would venture to say that a very high percentage of every taxpaying adult in this country, if you were they were to be audited or somehow, whether it be financially or like lifestyle audit or something, right, that you're going to find illegal activity because there's so much to be considered illegal activity in this world now.
It's right. Like, that you don't even know.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, I mean, well, technically you were doing 65, like that's an easy one, but it's like you're breaking a traffic law, you're doing something illegal, right? Like, well, I wrote this thing off of my tax return that I thought was right off of, but it's not. Well, that's illegal, right? Like, it's like, well, you just lied on a federal document, right? That's illegal, right? Like, it's like, oh my God, like.
Yeah, they make the laws so complex that, you know, there's so many laws and regulations and the laws are so complex that the majority of us are living outside of the law, even if we don't know it. You know, and of course, some of them are probably so minuscule that it's, even if we got caught doing it, it would be not a big deal. But me, for example, right, I tried to get a gun and I didn't know that. Well, when I went to court, I had two DUIs and the paperwork that I got from court said, you know, you can be locked up for a term of 90 days up to 1 year. And that was like in 2005. So 2016 rolls around, I try to purchase a gun. On the permit or on the paperwork, it says, have you ever been convicted of a crime where the jail sentence could have been over 1 year? And I said, no. Right. So months and months and months later, friggin' these people from the violent crime division of the state of Pennsylvania show up at my door and they start asking me all these questions. And they say, well, you answered no to this question on this paper. And I said, yeah, I was sentenced for 90 days up to a term of 1 year. And they said, no, you weren't. For your crime, you could have been sentenced up to 5 years in jail. And he said, well, where was that written? You know,
and
of course, ignorance of the law is no defense, but
no defense, I had
no idea. So, you know, hopefully I don't get charged with a crime, but that's a
lock them up, throw away the key.
That is a felony that could ruin my life. If they decided to charge me with that, they could say, you know what? This guy tried to purchase a firearm under false pretenses. He lied on a federal document and yeah. So, I mean, that's just a small thing. That's trying to purchase a gun, which everybody says you can do just like buying a quart of orange juice, which is bullshit. But, yeah, I mean, to open a hot dog stand, you guys know I was looking into something very, very similar, if not exactly that way. And I seriously started researching it, doing my, analysis of the market and everything that I have to go through. And just licensing, food safety, food service handling classes, the equipment, like what you have to label. You have to have a sticker on every single thing. You have to wear gloves if you're going to be touching this. You don't have to wear gloves if you're going to be touching that. There's so much that goes into it. It's like the profit margin like gets screwed up.
But squeezed.
Say, man, yep. I just want to get hot dogs that are already cooked, keep them in a cold place, throw them on a grill. Put them on a bun and give it to somebody. Like, how hard is that? Keep them cold, serve them hot. You know, that's not hard. But you know,
that should be your motto, too. Keep them cold, serve them hot.
And it just, it's just so much work and hoops you have to jump through. And it's like, well, you know, by the time I get done looking at all this stuff that I have to do, it's just like exhausting. It seems like something that should not be that hard.
Yeah. And then you spend weeks and weeks and weeks selling, like, 15 hot dogs.
Yeah.
You make about $30 profit and then they take that. But
guys, real quick, I think the keep them cold, sell them hot is the perfect motto for a beer and hot dog joint.
Shit.
You should do this.
Yeah.
The podcast without a name, a hot dog joint. Keep them cold.
If you're going to get a liquor license in the state of Pennsylvania, you better have about $300,000 in your pocket. And you can't even get one from the state anymore. You have to find somebody that's going to sell it to you, like privately. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we're probably really kind of like all falling on the same side here with this whole concept of man, let's chill out with all these different regulations and like requirements when it comes to entrepreneurs, right? We are a capitalist country. I know a lot of us are in denial of that and are hating on it, but the reality is that's what got us here. We need to keep fostering that. And this is a way of doing it because most of our businesses are small businesses, and we need to keep that moving along if we want to keep pushing forward as a country and growing and having like, an, you know, being that powerhouse economy that we've always been. We need things to keep fueling that. And that this is what we need
it to be. And like the cornerstone of any capitalistic society is innovation and entrepreneurship. And when you stifle that through regulation, you're kind of stifling what makes things work, you know? And like I said, you guys could speak on that more than I could, because I just did a little bit of research. You guys have actually been out on the street doing what you're doing. And it's
like, on the street, man, hustling every day.
Hustling, knocking on doors.
Knocking down doors. That's what I do. Anyway, we're
at 45 minutes.
Yeah, but that's not the true time. So we probably have about 10 minutes left. We could quickly touch on healthcare just because it's healthcare and we've talked about it before. It's boring. Well, it's boring insofar that it's always the same thing over and over again. We had two competing healthcare plans put out this past week, one from Lindsey Graham, the other one from our best friend and biggest fan, Bernie Sanders.
It's one of our 20 listeners, yeah. I think.
So I did the math on, the Lindsey Graham plan isn't even worth our time. It's the same thing as we've been saying. It's Obamacare light. It's not a free market solution. It's essentially just slowing the march to single payer. So let's talk about the single payer. I did some quick math for Bernie. I think, I forget what the estimates were. I think it was $32 trillion over 10 years. It will add to our debt or deficit. And what that comes out to is for every tax paying adult that we have, I think it's about 122 million tax paying adults right now. That comes out to about $26,000 a year per tax paying adult for 10 years. I did the math earlier today. So now you can look at it by the Bernie approach, which is he's going to want the wealthy to pay for it. So right now the top 20% pay 87% of taxes. So you could break it out like that and look at it that way. But in real terms, if we really kind of put it in context, it's $26,000 per tax paying adult for 10 years. So in a two tax paying adult house, that's over $50,000 of extra taxes you technically would have to pay a year for 10 years. It's not sustainable. That's the bottom line. Even if you had the top 20% pay for that, I don't think that would even be sustainable for them, because that's even overwhelming for them. So it's like, did you know also 45% of tax-paying adults do not pay taxes in our country? Or tax-paying age adults do not pay taxes in our country. Because of income or something like that. But then the top 20% pay 87% of federal income tax in our country. That's interesting. I just thought it was interesting.
That is interesting.
But anyway, but that's the gist of the two healthcares, right? But Bernie Sanders is a single payer. That's government universal healthcare. We knew that that's what Bernie Sanders wanted. He's always said he wanted it. We knew that that was the direction that Democrats wanted to go. 15 Democratic senators have come out to support him. I'm not surprised. Now, granted, I think 5 Democratic senators have opposed it. So he doesn't have, this is not going to go anywhere right now. Maybe in the next election cycle, 2018, potentially, if the Republicans keep not doing anything. Like, so it's really, we're spinning our wheels here once again. Lindsey Graham's is a bullshit one. It's essentially Obamacare light, which doesn't mean anything for their constituents. And Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders, man. Like, I didn't expect anything else from him. If he would have came out with a free market solution, I would run around my block naked, screaming, "I love Bernie Sanders!"
and then
I get arrested because I broke some obscure law. Well, not really obscure. I was just running around naked. That's probably legitimate.
Yeah. they'll seize your underwear.
Well, I won't have it. I'll be naked. They'll seize my house.
Oh, true. True.
They'll just take it off. Be like, well, give me your house. You're running around naked. F you.
Yeah, they'll shave your head and then they'll take they'll your
shave
hair.
My head, take my hair.
Shave your balls.
But that's the healthcare in a nutshell. I don't think we need to beat this one to death. I mean, do you guys have any thoughts on that or?
Yeah, I mean, not really. Honestly, the unsustainability of the single payer plan. I mean, I guess I think what people fall into is the trap of, you know, $3 trillion a year in added deficit, right? Well, it's just another $3 trillion. It's just a number. You know what I mean? Like, it's this ambiguous number that just, you know, comes from somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, and you know, at the end of the day, we can't sustain that kind of added debt, first of all. So it would have to come from taxpayers. And, you know, at least the majority of it would have to come from taxpayers. So, and like you just said, what did you say?
$23,000
a year, $26,000 a year per tax-paying adult. I mean, that's insane. You know, who would be able to do that? Now you're talking about crashes and everything else, you know, in every other market that's out there, you know, but then again, you'll talk to somebody that's like very pro, you know, Medicare for all, and they'll just kind of say, well, isn't it worth everybody having healthcare? You know what I mean? Like, that's the argument. I haven't had an argument about single payer with anybody yet that hasn't said, listen, anything is worth having healthcare for everybody. I'm like, okay, well, that's where we're at then. You know what I mean? Like,
I would say, show me.
And it's always a comeback to, like, well, I guess you don't care if everybody has healthcare, you know, but I do. Like,
I would say to them, show me people who are not getting healthcare.
Yeah, and between that and it's kind of like a, you know, condemning statement, right? It's like, well, I would love everybody to have healthcare, and I would love everybody in the country to be healthy, but at the same time, there is realistic things that go on. You know what I mean? Like, it needs to be realistic. It needs to be sustainable, and the rest of the country can't just, you know, fall to shit just because somebody came up with a plan that was kind of flawed. We've talked about this before.
Yeah,
I'm sure that there is a way to come up with a good, solid plan.
We agreed that we've done things better than any other country in the world ever. Right. I mean, most things we've done it better than other countries. I still maintain, and we've maintained in the past, that we could do this better. Right. We could find a way to do this better. Right. We don't have to do what has already been proven to be a failure, which is universal single payer healthcare. So, I mean, it comes down to quality and it comes down to liberty. Liberty has become kind of a bad word. Like, if you say liberty, it's like, oh, you're alt right, white supremacist. It's like, no, what it means is individual rights and an individual's ability to choose for themselves, right? So that's what this comes down to. It's your relationship with your doctor, what you want to do with your body based on your prognosis and on what you have gone out to do, discussed with a professional in this area, right? In a universal healthcare situation, you don't have that anymore. You're beholden to wait lists and like, the doctors are going to be spread thin. They're not going to be high quality. Innovation will go away. Your options will be much less.
And I had somebody argue with me about this, you know, and I'm not, you know, I'm not against a universal healthcare.
I'm not completely against it either.
Come up with a good, you know, quality, you know, system. But, you know, they can't, it's always stern in my face when I argue this is, well, Canada this, Canada that, right? Look, this doctor had an interview on YouTube that went viral on Facebook about how great their healthcare is. I'm like, well, look at the waiting list time. Like, I think our average waiting list is, gosh, I can't even remember. It's days, though.
It's probably less than a month. Probably weeks or days, yeah.
Right. So I think our average wait time, and this goes for specialists, life-threatening, like, you know, bypasses and stuff like that, heart bypasses, and also just a regular physician, like primary physician. And it was less than 20 days, if I remember correctly. But excuse me. So in Canada, the average across the board, including for heart bypass surgery, right, life-saving surgeries that might be necessary right away, the average expectancy to wait is about 20 weeks. And I don't think people you know, we're talking about a half a year almost. You know, you're talking 6 months that you might need to wait, 5 months, you know, for some sort of, you know, and I know that's an average, so it might be less, it might be more, you know what I mean? So it's, you know, it's not all that great. And I somebody chimed in and was like, well, you know, I spent a lot of time in Canada and everything is more expensive there as well. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they have free healthcare, but like everything else is way more expensive. So, you know, there's other things that happen. And that's a smaller population, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what's,
oh God, I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, it is a smaller population.
So, I mean, you're not even talking about the same type of population. You're also not talking about a scenario where you have so many illegal immigrants that we also need to take care of medically as well. You know what I mean? Because they're not just going to let them die either. You know what I mean? So,
and there's the defense burden too, which a lot of countries, yeah, European and North American, don't have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at least to the degree that America does, like being
right,
the world power,
exactly,
and de facto police force, right, and the, you know, the shield for our allies for the most part. But you know, I mean, there we have it. I agree with you. I'm not 100% against a universal healthcare. I just want to see the approach be in line with what got us here. We are a capitalist society. I'll say it again, whether you like it or not, that's what got us here. That's what made us the great country we are. Freedom, liberty, and free markets. I want to see that tried first. And we haven't really had that at all. It's always been crazy regulations around the health industry. And it almost sounds like horrible to say this, but it's like, I want to open it up. Like today it's like, oh, you open up, like the stigma on it is the greed's just going to take over. Well, not really. No, it's when you create specific things to take advantage of. If you let the market be the market has a lot of self-correcting things. And I'm not necessarily saying that the government doesn't have a say in this stuff. I do think that in free markets, there is a government function in education in particular for consumers. But I think we need to at least try what got us here first, open market, free market approach. And then if that doesn't work, it fails, then fine, let's do it. Let's try something else.
You know what, though? People will not go for it.
Never.
For the mere fact that it's not a immediate fix, right? So people want immediate, you know, instant satisfaction, right? That's like instant gratification. And that, you know, a free market solution would take a little bit of time to play out. And it's the right way to do it, in my eyes. But it would take a little bit of time for it to actually play out. And I don't think people are patient enough for that.
You know what else? God forbid someone would make money off of it. That CEO's making millions of dollars, that greedy bastard. Like that. Yeah. That's the other part people can't stand anymore. I mean, because of the narrative nowadays, it's like, oh, you make money, you're a bad person. You're bad if you made money.
Well, that's unless you're an athlete or a celebrity.
Yeah. It's okay.
Or the creator of Facebook or Apple.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know.
Then it's okay.
Did we lose anyway, Rich,
that's
by
a
the
whole
way?
Other is conversation for another time.
I feel like we may have lost Rich.
No, you didn't lose me. Okay. I felt like I shit all over Anthony in the last thing we were talking about. So I didn't want to, like,
what are you guys doing over there? Are you guys in the same location? Shitting on each other?
Don't call me again.
No, I felt like I was a little too vociferous in the last exchange that we had, so I wanted to, you know, Anthony be able to talk. I felt like I was interrupting and being a real nudge.
Well, you were being a real nudge, but I don't feel that you were interrupting me at all, so thank you for that.
And plus, I really don't, I mean, I've spoken ad nauseum on the whole healthcare thing, and since not a slight against you, but since you had to miss a couple, and I think healthcare was one of the ones that you weren't here for, I was actually kind of anxious to hear what you had to say.
Well, I appreciate it, and hopefully I completely disappointed you.
Yeah, like I matter. Sorry, that's it. Podcast over. Where Rich is disappointed. No, Joe pretty much was speaking for me anyway. I feel pretty much my Joe's opinion is my opinion.
I'm Rich's surrogate. I represent Rich.
And guys, if it sounded a little off, we had a few technical difficulties today. So yeah. Hopefully everything sounded okay.
I think I'll be able to fix most of it. We'll see. Anyway, this is episode 20 of the podcast without a name. We are on Facebook, at No Name Podcaster, on Twitter. We're on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, everywhere you want us to be. We're there for iTunes or podcast, I'm sorry. And so, Rich, you will have the last word. Like always, are you prepared?
The last word tonight is farts. No. The last word tonight is, hopefully, if you guys are good, and if these guys have time, maybe we'll treat you to a live stream. I can't promise anything, but if you're good, maybe we'll treat you to a live stream.
So the last word was maybe. We're not maybe. Stream.
Call me maybe.
Yeah, stream is a good last word.
Stream.
Stream.
We're streaming the podcast. We're streaming
it's the golden, our friendship. The golden stream.
Don't cross the streams unless you want to in the toilet later. We can do that.
Stream.